Welcome back to In Focus with David Coletto. I'm David Coletto. What is it like running the polling operation for a U.S. presidential election? My guest on this episode of In Focus is John Anzalone, one of America's top pollsters and messaging strategists. With more than 25 years of polling experience, John served as President Biden's chief pollster. Prior to working on the 2020 campaign, John polled for the Obama and Clinton campaigns and on dozens of Senate, gubernatorial, and congressional campaigns. Now, John and his firm say they have helped beat more incumbent Republicans and take back more Republican seats than any polling firm in the nation. We talked about his experience running the polling work for Biden's campaign, the state of American public opinion, President Biden's recovery plan, and whether he can start to break down polarization in the United States. Having the chance to interview John was such a privilege. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Well, John, thank you so much for taking the time to join the podcast today. How are you doing? So I've been interviewing a number of pollsters and researchers in the US, Canada, UK, and I've been starting with one question, which is, in your work, do you have an overarching philosophy or starting point when you analyze public opinion? Is there something that is your anchor by which, you know, guides your work?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it's to give a reality check. We just got out of the field with a poll yesterday for someone who's up for re-election, big city mayor. And the numbers are really good, right? But if you don't look a little deeper to find the cautionary tale in that, right? I'm kind of more cautiously optimistic than I am just optimistic. Because there's so many variables in the political dynamics of a campaign, in a modern campaign. Right. And so I think that you owe it to your clients, whether it's a candidate or whether it's a corporation or a nonprofit, to give them a reality check, right? And not just blow smoke up their ass. And I think that that can be often the challenge that you have on a purely, you know, researcher-based way to think of it. You know, you also don't want to be hurting, right? I mean, there's public polls, and that happens, I think, a lot of times in the national dynamics of presidential public polls, et cetera. You have to be really careful as a researcher not to hurt and to kind of trust your data. I've been in this business for 30 years, and so I've trained a lot of young people, including some of my partners in this firm. And my advice is always trust your data. And if you're seeing data that looks a little different than what the public, well, guess what? You're probably right, because we're spending a lot more time and a lot more money with high quality banks and lists to get it done right. And I think that that's kind of, you know, our approach.
I like that thinking to your first point about, like, don't be a cynic, but be a little bit of a pessimist. Look for the hole, right? The weakness that you might not obviously see, but you want to anticipate so a campaign can prepare for it or react to it when it might come.
Yeah, I had a young guy who we had hired, and then he moved on, which happens. It was amicable. And, you know, he had continued to dabble in polling, and he was taking on an incumbent in a primary. And he called me after they won. And he said that to me. He said, we saw we could win this thing, and we were moving and we were ahead. And I remember what you told me, which was trust the data. And he went to the candidate and he trusted his data and he laid it out, and they won. And so sometimes you just got to trust yourself and not what's going out in the noise.
And I think that's the value a pollster brings to a campaign. So let's talk briefly about the experience being the chief pollster on a national U.S. presidential campaign. Was this your first in the chief seat in terms of polling?
Well, you know, I was part of the polling team for both 2008 and 12 for Biden, and that was great. First, we did battleground states in North Carolina, Florida, in Virginia, and then in 2012 we kind of had a bigger role and did a lot of special projects for Axelrod and Messina, which were really a lot of fun. And then in 16, for Hillary, again, there was a polling team. And, you know, we were kind of co-heads. And in 2020, you know, that word gets thrown around a lot, chief pollster, but really we're a polling team. Celinda Lake, Silas Lee, Matt Barreto, John Della Volpe. You know, you work as a team, and that's really what's important. And everyone's kind of pulling their weight because these are really big operations. And so, you know, naturally you have national message polling, and we did a lot of that, but so did Celinda. And then, you know, there's battleground polling, which is really what it's all about at the end, right? I mean, it's not about national polling. Anytime we did the national polling, it's just really the battleground states aggregated. And then you have very specific Latino polling. Matt Barreto did that. Very specific African-American polling. Silas Lee, Dr. Silas Lee from New Orleans did that. John Della Volpe, who's really good at youth polling, even though he's an old guy like me. I call him Dorian Gray because he looks
He was one of the first interviews I did on,
on
the
podcast. Great guy. And so it was really a great team. And I don't think anyone lifts themselves up any higher than the other person. I had the benefit and the privilege of having known Biden, President Biden, for a long time, because I was a 23-year-old field operative in Iowa in his first presidential campaign. And so it was special to me, and, you know, knew not only him and his wife and his kids. And so it was a great 30-something year journey for me. And so it was really special.
And you worked on his primary campaign as well.
Right? Oh, yeah. No, I mean, we were, you know, I was engaged with him and the team even before he got into the race. And so really January of 2019. But I always tell people, and this really surprises them, is that we did no polling before he announced in April of 2019. This was a guy who absolutely knew why he was running, what he wanted to say to the American people. And he laid it out in April in Philly. And naturally, you do a lot of polling after that and things like that. But this wasn't a candidate who needed polling to know why he was running for president of the United States.
So give me a sense of, because again, we're mostly my audience is Canadian, and our campaigns are, if we're a tenth the size of the United States, but sure. I don't even think our campaigns are the tenth the size, right?
We've
got much stricter spending limits, and you know, you probably spent more. The Biden campaign probably spent more on polling than I hazard to guess that you know, the Liberals or the Conservatives here spent on the entire campaign,
right,
or even in the entire year of an election here. What, give me a sense of the scale of volume of research that's being done, you know, in those, let's say after the, you know, Biden clinches the nomination and you're prepping for the coming fight around the fall, you know, how much, you know, like research is being done, polling, yeah, I mean, focus groups.
Yeah,
other
I mean, listen, it's all public information, right? I mean, like, so there's no real trade secrets here, because everything has to be filed. But naturally, there is a very constant use of message polling, right? Because campaigns are about changing dynamics, right? Mm-hmm. So not only do you have your message, but the dynamics change. Oh, there's, you know, George Floyd, right? Or whatever it may be. There's Democratic conventions, Republican conventions. The President of the United States gets COVID. There's just so many things that change. You know, we bomb someplace, you know. And so there's message research done for your campaign messaging, but also the changing dynamics. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're doing that pretty much every month. But then you have the battleground states, right? And you're keeping tabs of 10 or 11 battleground states. And then at some point, you know, you always go and take a look at expansion states. Which again, this campaign was incredibly focused on 270. So they didn't go chase, you know, the shiny objects of, you know, Texas, right? Mm-hmm. To spend a lot of money there. And then again, there's constituencies. Republicans don't do this like we do this, but, you know, there's very specific polling for Latinos and African Americans. But there's also special projects, maybe for example, on women and things like that. And then there's all the qualitative. I mean, you're, you know, doing focus groups during COVID. We did more online, what we call qual boards, which are 3-day kind of interviews with people. You're not seeing the video.
Yeah.
And then there's, you know, you're testing ads and things like that, which mostly analytics in this operation did. But, you know, there's a lot of research and you want to keep tabs on things. And a lot, once you kind of get the messaging going, once the messages doesn't change a lot, you kind of refine them and tweak them, et cetera. A lot of it's keeping tabs of the battleground states, you know, to make sure you're where you need to be.
And I would assume, and I'm assuming this, so correct me if I'm wrong, that because of the budget that and the amount of money that was raised and therefore being able to spend, you had the ability, if an issue arose or a curiosity even, you know, let's test this, that you had the freedom to do that, in which that may not always be the case in campaigns.
Well, it wasn't in Hillary. I mean, we didn't do sustained tracking in October in the Clinton campaign. I mean, it's been widely reported. And, you know, that was a problem, right? The Biden campaign had a lot of money and it had the luxury to do a lot of things, not just on the research side, but on the paid communication side, on the field side, et cetera. It is nice to be in that position to be able to do a Cadillac program of research, not just to do the Cadillac program and to make money or whatever. It's just really nice to be able to do research the right way without, you know, restrictions or constrictions of what you're doing. So you're making good decisions rather than bad decisions, right? And that's a luxury because, you know, most campaigns don't have that. I do Governor Roy Cooper, North Carolina, a really robust research budget. The campaign manager believed in it. And we were able to do the things that we needed to do and not guess, right? If you're attacked, whether it's a gubernatorial campaign, Senate campaign, or presidential, you want to go in there and do, you know, the attack and response, right? You want to test the attack. You want to test your responses and, you know, help the paid communication people put together really good responses. And that's better not left to guessing.
So I want to take our listeners and you kind of back to the nominating process, the primary, and just quickly run through that, the start of 2020, right? And at the start of 2020, a month or so before the Iowa caucus, President Biden led Bernie Sanders. I know national polls don't matter, but he led him by 9 points in the national preference polls. But then he comes fourth in Iowa, fifth in New Hampshire, and comes second in Nevada, 26 points behind Sanders, right? And then by the end of February, you see that reversal in those national polls where Biden is now trailing Senator Sanders by 12 points. You know what happens next? Biden wins the landslide in South Carolina and then pretty much cruises to the nomination.
Yeah.
How are you feeling as the pollster at that point? And I'm just curious, like, is that expected?
And the only thing I would dispute there is most of the national polls were basically a straight line. I don't remember any national polls that were having Bernie Sanders ahead. You know, we have a strange nominating process. We have a caucus where people physically have to go to a building or a home, et cetera. And so it doesn't replicate reality of what is most of the primary season, which is people get up and they have their cup of coffee and they go and vote at some point between 7 a.m. and 8 p.m., right? And then you go to New Hampshire and you have a favorite son, Bernie, and a favorite daughter, Warren. And then you go back to a caucus, right, in Nevada, in a city where, quite frankly, most of the people who work there work at night because it's the tourism industry, right? And so none of that replicates reality. And then you go to South Carolina where it's a real primary, and then you go to Super Tuesday, which is all real primaries. And then we, you know, kick some ass in Michigan, right? Which Hillary lost to Bernie. And so the actual national polls were pretty stable, you know, and we knew, we felt, we knew that as long as once we got to a primary, you know, a real primary and not a caucus or not a hybrid or not a favorite son, favorite daughter, that, you know, we would regain the insider momentum. What we also believed was it was important to come in second in Nevada. Forget the margin.
Right.
We just, you know, if you remember, Buttigieg and Klobuchar were kind of the stars of that time, both in Iowa and New Hampshire, even though Bernie won. And so they had a little surge. And so it was really important to be number two in Nevada. And we did. And we did it by changing our strategy and changing our TV ads. We were the only ones running, you know, about taking on the NRA, Mandalay Bay, October 1 had happened in Nevada, et cetera. And I think it was really an important strategic tool or strategic decision there, both by Anita Don. Jen O'Malley was on the ground before she became the campaign manager. And so, you know, I'm not going to sit there and say we weren't, there wasn't some worry, but it was really more a worry about coming in second than it was what was going to happen in South Carolina.
And did the, and I'm assuming, again, it had, it affected everything. The pandemic sort of ramping up in early 2020 into March, did that help change the frame of that election? But did you also see it in the data? Like, did the pandemic reset the way voters and Democrats were looking at the candidates in this choice?
In the in the primary.
In the primaries. Yeah, yeah.
No, I don't think that the you got to remember, I was with Biden on March 8th, 9th, and 10th for the Michigan primary because I do Whitmer, and I was flying around with them, and it was great. On primary day, which was the 10th, you know, I didn't go with him to Ohio, so I talked with him in the terminal, and they were going to Cleveland. Once they landed, they had called off the rally. And so Michigan was literally the last right. election. And that night we won every county. Right. We won the city of Detroit. We won the suburbs and we won the blue collar, you know, working class counties like Macomb, right? We won every county in Michigan and it was over. Right. And so I don't think, and really the pandemic started that next day in a sense, because that's when everything was shut down in terms of personal campaigning. But at that point, the trajectory was where it needed to be, right? Okay. Now, the pandemic, I think, changed the dynamics clearly of the general election, because it was the first time in some ways that Trump was judged as president of the United States. And his bungling of, you know, coronavirus, you know, people judged him harshly. On how, you know, he basically didn't handle it. And Biden was a person people knew had a lot of experience. And so, you know, they knew that, you know, Biden laid out his plan. He had a COVID plan. And so, you know, in a lot of ways, Trump not stepping up as president of the United States, you know, certainly changed the pandemic changed the dynamic and how people viewed him.
Hypotheticals are always fool's errand, but I'm going to try one here. I think, you know, to your point about this thing was the primary was more or less, you said, you know, close to decided when you swept Michigan, but had a less experienced candidate won this election, that won the Democratic nomination. Do you see that they would have faced a tougher task because of, even though perceptions around Trump's handling of COVID were very poor, he was still the incumbent, right? Whereas right. Biden, it turns out, appears to be the, you know, the candidate for the job right now, right? With
right.
the experience that he had as a senator and past VP. Was that, did that give him extra lift in making that case that,
well, listen,
you know, while you weren't electing and re-electing an incumbent, you were basically
sure.
getting an incumbent.
But I think that there was multiple traits about Joe Biden that his strengths pushed off perfectly against Trump's vulnerabilities, right? I mean, one is Trump, without a doubt, you know, mishandled the coronavirus and, you know, showed no leadership, had no plan. Biden is experienced, and you know, he laid out a plan on what he would do. But also, Trump was a guy who, you know, bad behavior, kind of an ass, like demeaned people, right? Treated people poorly, didn't have a problem vocalizing that. Biden, a compassionate, empathetic guy, great, you know, deep faith, you know, love your neighbor, et cetera, et cetera. Embrace people. You know, and so again, pushing off of literally the fatigue of Trump's behavior. But also you had, you know, Trump, who kind of came in as a populist, going to be for the working man and woman, and that didn't really pan out. And here you have Lunch Pail Joe, right? Whose, you know, father was unemployed, had they had to move, scrappy upbringing, and always had kind of fought for the middle class. And so there was a lot of things about Biden that pushed off of Trump's weaknesses. Trump was the most divisive person we've ever seen. Biden was all about unity and bringing people together to get things done. So when you talk about, you know, Biden became the right guy at the right time because he had all of these really important traits that America wanted at that point in time, right? And that's including being a moderate who just ran against 18 more liberal people, including a socialist. So Trump would attack him. I think one of the malpractices of the Trump campaign is that they attacked him from June until November, and our favorability ratings went up. They never kind of realized that they tried 10 different hits on us and none of them worked. Well, the one that they just kept driving was that he was a radical left guy. And no one believed it because he wasn't a radical left guy. He was the moderate guy who ran against the socialists. So, you know, all good.
I want to talk about that in a moment. That's so interesting. Just one more question on polling. Your colleagues at ALG Research, and I think a number of other Democratic-leaning pollster came out with a really interesting piece about why you guys thought the public polls anyways, and I was wondering if you were seeing it in your internal stuff, seemed to underestimate, you know, the Trump vote and Republicans generally, even in some of the Senate elections.
And, I think we said we overstated the Democratic vote. Is that the same thing?
Lead maybe, but...
That was trying to be a pollster joke, but keep going.
Yeah. I'm curious if you want to just kind of summarize your sense of why, you know, what's happening with the polls. Because I think we see it in Canada to some extent, we see it in the UK, that there's a segment of the conservative voter group right now, animated in the UK by Brexit, animated by Trump, obviously, in the US. Canada, there's less of that kind of factor, but we still, almost every pollster underestimated the conservative vote in 2019. What do you think's explains that and how are you trying to adjust for it?
You know, there is a universe of voter who does not trust institutions, including government. They don't trust the news media. And here's maybe the most important part. They don't trust other people, right? Mm-hmm. And we have now added in our demographics, just basically, do you generally trust, you know, other people, or do you generally not trust other people? And, you know, and so, listen, I think what we have found is that we constantly have to innovate. First, just admit that there's a problem. Like there's some pollsters out here that want to like literally hide behind margin of error. Let's just kind of get beyond that. That there are some problems. So diagnose the problem and come up with a plan and a solution to get better and innovate. Most of the public polls, use only one mode. We have now gone to multimodal, right? So we're doing, you know, very small number of landlines and a big universe of cell and what we also call text to web, right? So it goes to your, you know, the initial message goes to your phone or your whatever, and then you're taking that online and you're not getting the social pressures or the biases from the interviewer, et cetera. And we are finding that those text to web interviews are a lot different. Right? You can take them anonymously. They're much more conservative. And they look a hell of a lot different than the people that we're getting on the phone or even in panels, which are highly educated. So it's all about innovation. It's all about, you know, trying to stay ahead of the curve and finding those people. Now, I also think, and I truly believe this, that there's a Trump variable that you can't quantify. Like, you know, there's only people who will come out to vote for Trump, who's somewhat of a cult leader, and they probably won't come out to vote ever again. We saw that in the Georgia Senate elections, a big drop off with some white voters, heavy Trump voters, who voted in November when Trump was on the ballot and didn't vote in January when he wasn't on the ballot. And they're never going to vote, you know, if Trump is not on the ballot. And those voters are probably gone forever. I don't know what the number is. I don't know how to quantify it. And it'll take another election cycle probably to get there. But there is without a doubt, Trump kind of messes with polling in a way that we have never seen before.
Right. And I think just to your point about trust and that question is so important. Do you think it might be that those folks who don't trust these institutions and that trust is increasing, in the past, their vote intentions may have been more variable, right? Like,
or they didn't vote. I mean, that's the other point.
They didn't vote overwhelmingly for one candidate or party. And so even if we didn't capture them or we didn't pick them up, their error was distributed throughout, right?
Sure, whereas if
they are aligning with one political, like I think conservative parties are generally appealing to that group, right? I think of Brexit, same kind of message, right? If they are aligning and either showing up and voting, which they might normally not do, but also not answering our surveys as often as others, but they overwhelmingly vote for a differently than those who do, then you get the error, right? So I do think there's something there with that. I agree. It's hard to figure out how to adjust for it, but something's happening with a subset of the electorate.
No doubt about it. I mean, listen, polling is still incredibly relevant. It's hard to do. It is increasingly more expensive. What the public media polls do is much different than what we do.
Right.
We spend a lot more money and time and effort into it. Their error and how they analyze gets conflated with what we do, and there's nothing we can do about that. But it's, again, I just think why we put that out with some really fantastic colleagues in this space, competitors, but colleagues, is that, you know, we need to acknowledge that there's problems. More importantly, we have to have a plan to fix them and get as good data as possible. At the end of the day, we're not just prognosticators. 90% of what we do is message development and targeting. I often like to say the current voter, what we call the head-to-head, is the least important question we have in a poll. What we are trying to do is help our candidates or clients or corporations, whatever, with good message and strategy. And that won't change. And ironically, you know, not getting hardcore Trump voters doesn't change our strategy, because those people are our persuadable universe anyway. But it's still important for us to try to get as correct as possible, even in the head-to-head.
Yeah, I mean, even the head-to-head's the only number that needs to be within 1 or 2 points right. Because even if you're within 4 points of a message test, doesn't change your strategy, right?
Well, the other thing is that I learned this, you know, you learn after 30 years, but you also learn after 4 years, is that, you know, we learned in the Clinton campaign that she pulled what she got. And we learned that in Biden, like, you know, I always say Jen O'Malley never asked me what the margin was in a state. She always asked me where Biden was. And we always wanted to be at 49, 50, 51. And if you go to, even in the public polls, 538 or RCP, Real Clear Politics, and you look at all the battleground states that we, you know, won or lost, and where was the aggregate on election day where Biden was and what he got, all within a point, point and a half. And, you know, again, the media can't report that. They're only going to report the margin. We analyze that, and that's how we come up with where we're going to win, where we're going to lose, but more importantly, where we're going to switch resources. You know, we saw that North Carolina and Florida, not going to happen. But we saw that Georgia was really an opportunity. I always believed we were going to win it. And, you know, making good decisions about resources, I think, probably put it over the top.
Interesting. And which is a lesson from the Clinton campaign, where if you weren't tracking those final weeks, you may not have saw that opportunity. Okay. before you're so kind with your time. Yeah. I did see an interview you recently did with Axios talking about President Biden's infrastructure plan, how to pay for it, the idea of taxing corporations and people earning more than $400,000 a year. We're having the same debate in Canada about how do you pay for the recovery and all the spending we've done to get people through this the past year. Issue of tax fairness. You know, what's your gut and your data say about the political opportunity there to unite actually disparate parts of the electorate into actually agreeing that, you know, it's okay and we should do it?
Yeah, I mean, almost two-thirds of Americans, and again, I don't know much about your tax system, but almost about two-thirds of Americans support increasing the corporate tax. Two-thirds of Americans support increasing tax on households making over $400,000. These are things that Joe Biden laid out in the campaign, and, you know, he's, has a pay for his programs right now. But here's what I think is really important in terms of middle-class Americans pre-pandemic felt like they weren't getting ahead. They weren't benefiting from their hard work. The economy was going and, you know, all the benefits were going to the top. Their salaries and wages weren't increasing, but the prices of cost of living was going up. And so this is just a matter of fairness. Like, you know, middle-class people aren't anti-corporation. They're not anti-rich. They're anti not paying your fair share. And so this is really just out of a frustration of middle-class families knowing that they are the ones carrying the tax burden in America and that the wealthy, and especially the ultra wealthy, you know, use their power and accountants and attorneys and the tax laws, you know, to kind of skirt paying their fair share. And so when they see the top, whatever, 50 American companies barely paying any taxes, it pisses them off. And so, you know, this is kind of a no-brainer. And what I was trying to say in Axios was really Democrats need to take control of this narrative, that regardless of what happens, they're going to be accused as tax increasers by Republicans because that's their branding. So take control of the narrative. When Trump hit us on taxes, we said, uh-uh, not true. Your taxes aren't going up. We're going to raise taxes on those making over $400,000 in big corporations to pay for investments in education, the economy, and healthcare. That is a winning message. And if you control that message and control your narrative on taxes, it will be a net plus. And I don't think that we have to be, I don't think Democrats have to be afraid of that.
And it's interesting that, you know, you hear Secretary Yellen talking about a global minimum corporate tax. Mm-hmm. And there seems to be a movement building around that, which you're going to, you know, with the Trudeau government here in Canada and some other progressive governments, there may be some momentum on that front. I do want to connect the dots between, this is my last question for you. There was, I don't know if you've read the piece in The Atlantic that just came out. The headline was, or the title was, "Welcome to the New Progressive Era." And it goes on and tells the story of the first 100 days of the Biden presidency and how he has effectively united the Democratic Party. And it quotes, you know, a number of progressive Congress people, senators saying, you know, we didn't expect this when he won the nomination, but he has turned out to be somebody who we feel we can work with. And you name a whole bunch of issues. And it turns out that the guy that maybe most voters would say was the most moderate of the candidates running is turning out to maybe be one of the most progressive presidents, at least in his first 100 days. What's your thoughts on how that first 100 days is that
one is he's always been a progressive, right? I mean, you can be a moderate and a progressive. And I've always kind of, it always gets me a little aggravated, not you, but I mean, that progressives in some ways want to hijack what a progressive is, right? Because he's always been progressive. I mean, my God, this was the top elected officials who came out for gay marriage, you know, before most Democrats did, right? I mean, you can go down the line. But I think that you said he's the president to unite progressives. What he's actually becoming is the president who's uniting the American people, right? I mean, he filled a leadership void. And quite frankly, the type of president that he is becoming in 100 days is like, he diagnoses a problem, right? He puts together a plan. He brings experts around him and he executes it. He's become like an action figure, right? Yeah. I mean, he, in a crisis, we have a healthcare crisis, a COVID crisis, an economic crisis, a school crisis, a racial justice crisis. These are big, big problems. And he is thinking really big about how to fix them and solve them. And at the same time, you know, bring some help to working families. And so those are progressivists, great, but they're also, you know, he's United America behind us. I mean, some of the support levels for the American Rescue Plan and the American Jobs Plan are in the 70s, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that is kind of, those are crazy numbers in such a divisive America. And that's why he has a 55% average job rating, a 60% job rating on coronavirus, like almost a 70% job rating on vaccine distribution, and over 50% job rating on the economy, higher than Trump's job rating on the economy when he left. It's extraordinary.
And I think it's partly because, and they make this point in the article, is because he's leading, but it's not about him.
It's not about him.
Not about him.
I mean, when he wakes up in the morning and shaves, he looks in the mirror, he doesn't see Joe Biden. Like, he sees the American people.
And that's 180 from the previous president. And even, you know, President Obama was, and I'm a big fan, and Canadians are big fans of President Obama, but he still had a charisma and an aura about him that was always about, even if he didn't think it was about him, it was in a way always about him. But Biden's ability to bring people together to find solutions, whether you're on the far left or the right or wherever of the country, it feels like both the polling is suggesting it and the outcome that is what the country needed at this moment, with somebody who said, this is, you know, it's not about me.
That's exactly right.
So last question.
All right, here we go.
What's your outlook for, you know, American public opinion over the next few years? I mean, it's a hard, I don't want a prediction, but it's been so polarized. And, you know, I'm always shocked by how just, you know, even on a question of like, was the election rigged, and the number of Republicans who think, you know, crazy things, no offense to Republicans thinking crazy things, but yeah. Is that a symptom that will slowly disappear more that Trump is out of the rearview mirror, or is it a fact of American public opinion going forward?
The answer is, I don't know. I mean, listen, when you have, like, just within the last 24 hours, and you have the Chauvin trial in Minneapolis, in Brooklyn Heights or whatever, Minneapolis, you have the shooting there that killed the person. In Chicago, you know, the 13-year-old boy who gets shot, you know, in Indianapolis, 8 people dead because of guys shooting. I mean, there's just like, right, there's always going to be things that like bring up and pick off the scab of where the camps are, right? Whether it's racial, whether it's economic, you know, whether it's gun rights, whatever it is. And so it's not easy to open the wounds. Mm-hmm. But here's what I would say. This country, just like Canada and everywhere, has gone through a traumatic event in the last year, right, with COVID. The one thing that we see in the polling and the focus groups, et cetera, is a sense of optimism. Like, they see the light at the end of the tunnel, even with the variants and things like that. Like, what Biden has done on the vaccine distribution, et cetera, and what that means for the economy and people going back to school and stuff like that, you know, families being able to send their kids back to school and childcare, huge psychological benefit. And so there's a lot of optimism about what the next 6 months, year, year and a half, 2 years holds. And that makes me feel good about maybe some of these fissures, can be healed.
At the start of 2020, the percentage of Americans who said the country's headed in the right direction was around 30%, low 30s.
Yeah.
Right. I think the most recent numbers are suggesting we're up in the high 40s, up into the 50s.
Basically,
numbers 50. You have not seen.
Yeah. Right.
So your point about optimism.
But when you ask about people's financial situation, their optimism, it's 68% are optimistic in the next 6 months about their financial situation. So, I mean, like, you know, there's a different ways to measure it. People aren't going to be like, you know, high numbers of optimism for government or public officials, et cetera. But they see that they're going to be able to go to a restaurant or go on vacation or have send their kids back to school. Something as simple as send their kids back to school or get their kid in childcare. So, you know, the 4 million women who, you know, had to drop out of the workforce can go back to work. And so, you know, it's going to be the little things that really, really matter.
But and I think my point was, like, that's still a good number. That's a great number compared to where it was in June, which was 22%, right? Yeah. The mindset is shifting. And, you know, when we ask Canadians, because U.S. is so important and we follow U.S. politics so much, how do you think the United States is headed in the right direction, wrong direction? And I think in July, August of 2020, like only about 15% of Canadians thought the U.S. was headed in the right direction. Today, you're up to 40, right? So even our success is your success. We're, much as you guys don't pay as much attention to us, we pay a lot of attention to you.
Yeah.
And so that optimism that you're feeling carries over the border.
Well, now I spent a lot of my time going over the Ambassador Bridge. So,
you know, Windsor and Essex County really well. Yeah.
But to put a bow on this, you know, by the end of the year, it is very likely a majority to 60% of Americans will think the country's moving in the right direction. And I just have one thing to say. Thank you, Joe Biden. I mean, he's filling a leadership void. He diagnoses problems. He gets a plan together. He surrounds himself with experts and they execute it. And he's being rewarded for that. The new action figure hero, Joe Biden.
Let's leave it there. John Anselm, thank you so much. A privilege. Thank you.
Hey, thanks for having me. Appreciate it, brother.
Take care.
Bye.